and the day after, merely to avoid responsibility or to please the emperor, would declare that he had no opinion at all on the matter. Another who wished to gain some advantage would attract the emperor's attention by loudly advocating the very thing the emperor had hinted at the day before, and would dispute and shout at the council, beating his breast and challenging those who did not agree with him to duels, thereby proving that he was prepared to sacrifice himself for the common good. A third, in the absence of opponents between two councils, would simply solicit a special gratuity for his faithful services, well knowing that at that moment people would be too busy to refuse him. A fourth, while seemingly overwhelmed with work, would often come accidentally under the emperor's eye. A fifth, to achieve his long-cherished aim of dining with the emperor, would stubbornly insist on the correctness or falsity of some newly emerging opinion, and for this object would produce arguments more or less forcible and correct. All the men of this party were fishing for rubles, decorations, and promotions, and in this pursuit watched only the weathercock of imperial favour, and directly they noticed it turning in any direction, this whole drone population of the army began blowing hard that way, so that it was all the harder for the emperor to turn it elsewhere. Amid the uncertainties of the position, with the menace of serious danger giving a peculiarly threatening character to everything, amid this vortex of intrigue, egotism, conflict of views and feelings, and the diversity of race among these people, this eighth and largest party of those preoccupied with personal interests imparted great confusion and obscurity to the common task. Whatever question arose, a swarm of these drones, without having finished their buzzing on a previous theme, flew over to the new one, and by their hum drowned and obscured the voices of those who were disputing honestly. From among all these parties, just at the time Prince Andrei reached the army, another, a ninth party, was being formed, and was beginning to raise its voice. This was the party of the elders, reasonable men, experienced and capable in state affairs, who, without sharing any of those conflicting opinions, were able to take a detached view of what was going on at the staff at headquarters, and to consider means of escape from this muddle, indecision, intricacy and weakness. The men of this party said and thought that what was wrong resulted chiefly from the emperor's presence in the army with his military court, and from the consequent presence there of an indefinite, conditional, and unsteady fluctuation of relations, which is in place at court, but harmful in an army. That a sovereign should reign, but not command the army, and that the only way out of the position would be for the emperor and his court to leave the army, that the mere presence of the emperor paralysed the action of 50,000 men required to secure his personal safety, and that the worst commander-in-chief, if independent, would be better than the very best one, trammelled by the presence and authority of the monarch. Just at the time Prince Andrei was living unoccupied at Drissa, Shishkov, the Secretary of State and one of the chief representatives of this party, wrote a letter to the emperor, which Arakcheyev and Balashyov agreed to sign. In this letter, availing himself of permission given him by the emperor to discuss the general course of affairs, he respectfully suggested, on a plea that it was necessary for the sovereign to arouse a warlike spirit in the people of the capital, that the emperor should leave the army. That arousing of the people by their sovereign and his call to them to defend their country, the very incitement which was the chief cause of Russia's triumph, in so far as it was produced by the Tsar's personal presence in Moscow, was suggested to the emperor and accepted by him as a pretext for his quitting the army. Chapter 10. Prince Andrei is introduced to Pfuel. This letter had not yet been presented to the emperor when Barclay, one day at dinner, informed Bolkonski that the sovereign wished to see him personally, to question him about Turkey, and that Prince Andrei was to present himself at Bennigsen's quarters at 6 that evening. News was received at the emperor's quarters that very day of a fresh movement by Napoleon which might endanger the army. News subsequently found to be false. and that morning Colonel Michaud had ridden round the Drissa fortifications with the Emperor and had pointed out to him that this fortified camp constructed by Pfuel, until then considered a chef-d'œuvre of tactical science which would ensure Napoleon's destruction, was an absurdity, threatening the destruction of the Russian army. Prince Andrei arrived at Bennigsen's quarters, a country gentleman's house of moderate size, situated on the very banks of the river. Neither Bennigsen nor the Emperor was there, but Chernyshev, the Emperor's aide-de-camp, received Bolkonski and informed him that the Emperor, accompanied by General Bennigsen and Marquis Paulucci, had gone a second time that day to inspect the fortifications of the Drissa camp, of the suitability of which serious doubts were beginning to be felt. Chernyshev was sitting at a window in the first room with a French novel in his hand. The room had probably been a music room. There was still an organ in it on which some rugs were piled, and in one corner stood the folding bedstead of Bennigsen's adjutant. This adjutant was also there, and sat dozing on the rolled-up bedding, evidently exhausted by work or by feasting. Two doors led from the room, one straight on into what had been the drawing-room, and another on the right to the study. Through the first door came the sound of voices conversing in German and occasionally in French. In that drawing-room were gathered, by the Emperor's wish, not a military council, the Emperor preferred indefiniteness, but certain persons whose opinions he wished to know in view of the impending difficulties. It was not a council of war, but, as it were, a council to elucidate certain questions for the Emperor personally. To this semi-council had been invited the Swedish General Armfelt, Adjutant General Voltsogen, Vinsingerode, whom Napoleon had referred to as a renegade French subject, Michaud, Toll, Count Stein, who was not a military man at all, and Pfuel himself, who, as Prince Andrei had heard, was the mainspring of the whole affair. Prince Andrei had an opportunity of getting a good look at him, for Pfuel arrived soon after himself, and in passing through the drawing-room, stopped a minute to speak to Chernyshev. At first sight, Pfuel, in his ill-made uniform of a Russian general, which fitted him badly like a fancy costume, seemed familiar to Prince Andrei, though he saw him now for the first time. There was about him something of Weyrother, Mack, and Schmidt, and many other German theorist generals whom Prince Andrei had seen in 1805, but he was more typical than any of them. Prince Andrei had never yet seen a German theorist in whom all the characteristics of those others were united to such an extent. Pfuel was short and very thin but broad-boned, of coarse, robust build, broad in the hips and with prominent shoulder blades. His face was much wrinkled and his eyes deep-set. His hair had evidently been hastily brushed smooth in front of the temples, but stuck up behind in quaint little tufts. He entered the room looking restlessly and angrily around, as if afraid of everything in that large apartment. Awkwardly holding up his sword, he addressed Chernyshev and asked in German where the Emperor was. One could see that he wished to pass through the rooms as quickly as possible, finish with the bows and greetings, and sit down to business in front of a map, where he would feel at home. He nodded hurriedly in reply to Chernyshev, and smiled ironically on hearing that the sovereign was inspecting the fortifications that he, Pfuel, had planned in accord with his theory. He muttered something to himself abruptly and in a bass voice, as self-assured Germans do. It might have been, "Stupid fellow," or "The whole affair will be ruined, or something absurd will come of it." Prince Andrei did not catch what he said, and would have passed on, but Chernyshev introduced him to Pfuel, remarking that Prince Andrei was just back from Turkey, where the war had terminated so fortunately. Pfuel barely glanced, not so much at Prince Andrei as past him, and said with a laugh, "That must have been a fine tactical war," and laughing contemptuously, went on into the room from which the sound of voices was heard. Pfuel, always inclined to be irritably sarcastic, was particularly disturbed that day, evidently by the fact that they had dared to inspect and criticise his camp in his absence. From this short interview with Pfuel, Prince Andrei, thanks to his Austerlitz experiences, was able to form a clear conception of the man. Pfuel was one of those hopelessly and immutably self-confident men, self-confident to the point of martyrdom, as only Germans are, because only Germans are self-confident on the basis of an abstract notion, science, that is, the supposed knowledge of absolute truth. A Frenchman is self-assured because he regards himself personally, both in mind and body, as irresistibly attractive to men and women. An Englishman is self-assured as being a citizen of the best organized state in the world, and therefore, as an Englishman, always knows what he should do, and knows that all he does as an Englishman is undoubtedly correct. An Italian is self-assured because he is excitable and easily forgets himself and other people. A Russian is self-assured just because he knows nothing, does not want to know anything, since he does not believe that anything can be known. The German's self-assurance is worst of all, stronger and more repulsive than any other, because he imagines that he knows the truth, science, which he himself has invented, but which is for him the absolute truth. Pfuel was evidently of that sort. He had a science, the theory of oblique movements deduced by him from the history of Frederick the Great's wars, and all he came across in the history of more recent warfare seemed to him absurd and barbarous, monstrous collisions in which so many blunders were committed by both sides that these wars could not be called wars. They did not accord with the theory, and therefore could not serve as material for science. In 1806, Pfuel had been one of those responsible for the plan of campaign that ended in Jena and Auerstadt, but he did not see the least proof of the fallibility of his theory in the disasters of that war. On the contrary, the deviations made from his theory were, in his opinion, the sole cause of the whole disaster, and with characteristically gleeful sarcasm he would remark, "There, I said the whole affair would go to the devil." Pfuel was one of those theoreticians who so love their theory that they lose sight of the theory's object, its practical application. His love of theory made him hate everything practical, and he would not listen to it. He was even pleased by failures, for failures resulting from deviations in practice from the theory only proved to him the accuracy of his theory. He said a few words to Prince Andrei and Chernyshev about the present war, with the air of a man who knows beforehand that all will go wrong, and who is not displeased that it should be so. The unbrushed tufts of hair sticking up behind and the hastily brushed hair on his temples expressed this most eloquently. He passed into the next room, and the deep, querulous sounds of his voice were at once heard from there. Chapter 11. An Informal Council of War. Prince Andrei's eyes were still following Pfuel out of the room when Count Bennigsen entered hurriedly, and nodding to Bolkonski but not pausing, went into the study, giving instructions to his adjutant as he went. The Emperor was following him, and Bennigsen had hastened on to make some preparations and to be ready to receive the sovereign. Chernyshev and Prince Andrei went out into the porch, where the Emperor, who looked fatigued, was dismounting. Marquis Paolucci was talking to him with particular warmth, and the Emperor, with his head bent to the left, was listening with a dissatisfied air. The Emperor moved forward, evidently wishing to end the conversation, but the flushed and excited Italian, oblivious of decorum, followed him and continued to speak.
"And as for the man who advised forming this camp, the Drissa camp," said Paolucci, as the Emperor mounted the steps, and noticing Prince Andrei scanned his unfamiliar face, "as to that person, sire," continued Paolucci, desperately, apparently unable to restrain himself, "the man who advised the Drissa camp, I see no alternative but the lunatic asylum or the gallows."
Without heeding the end of the Italian's remarks, and as though not hearing them, the Emperor, recognizing Bolkonski, addressed him graciously.
"I am very glad to see you. Go in there, where they are meeting, and wait for me."
The Emperor went into the study. He was followed by Prince Pyotr Mikhailovich Bolkonski and Baron Stein, and the door closed behind them.
Prince Andrei, taking advantage of the Emperor's permission, accompanied Paolucci, whom he had known in Turkey, into the drawing-room where the council was assembled. Prince Pyotr Mikhailovich Volkonsky occupied the position, as it were, of chief of the Emperor's staff. He came out of the study into the drawing-room with some maps, which he spread on a table, and put questions on which he wished to hear the opinions of the gentlemen present. What had happened was that news, which afterwards proved to be false, had been received during the night of a movement by the French to outflank the Drissa camp. The first to speak was General Armfelt, who, to meet the difficulty that presented itself, unexpectedly proposed a perfectly new position away from the Petersburg and Moscow roads. The reason for this was inexplicable, unless he wished to show that he too could have an opinion, but he urged that at this point the army should unite and there await the enemy. It was plain that Armfelt had thought out that plan long ago, and now expounded it not so much to answer the questions put, which, in fact, his plan did not answer, as to avail himself of the opportunity to air it. It was one of the millions of proposals, one as good as another, that could be made as long as it was quite unknown what character the war would take. Some disputed his arguments, others defended them. Young Count Toll objected to the Swedish general's views more warmly than anyone else, and in the course of the dispute drew from his side pocket a well-filled notebook, which he asked permission to read to them. In these voluminous notes Toll suggested another scheme, totally different from Armfelt's or Pfuel's plan of campaign. In answer to Toll, Paolucci suggested an advance and an attack, which he urged could alone extricate us from the present uncertainty and from the trap, as he called the Drissa camp, in which we were situated. During all these discussions, Fuel and his interpreter Voltsogen, his bridge in court relations, were silent. Fuel only snorted contemptuously and turned away, to show that he would never demean himself by replying to such nonsense as he was now hearing. So when Prince Volkonsky, who was in the chair, called on him to give his opinion, he merely said, "Why ask me? General Armfelt has proposed a splendid position with an exposed rear. Or why not this Italian gentleman's attack? Very fine. Or a retreat, also good. Why ask me?" said he. "Why, you yourselves know everything better than I do." But when Volkonsky said with a frown that it was in the Emperor's name that he asked his opinion, Fuel rose and, suddenly growing animated, began to speak. "Everything has been spoilt, everything muddled. Everybody thought they knew better than I did, and now you come to me. How mend matters? There is nothing to mend. The principles laid down by me must be strictly adhered to," said he, drumming on the table with his bony fingers. "What is the difficulty? Nonsense, childishness." He went up to the map, and speaking rapidly, began proving that no eventuality could alter the efficiency of the Drissa camp, that everything had been foreseen, and that if the enemy were really going to outflank it, the enemy would inevitably be destroyed. Paolucci, who did not know German, began questioning him in French. Voltsogen came to the assistance of his chief, who spoke French badly, and began translating for him, hardly able to keep pace with Fuel, who was rapidly demonstrating that not only all that had happened, but all that could happen, had been foreseen in his scheme, and that if there were now any difficulties, the whole fault lay in the fact that his plan had not been precisely executed. He kept laughing sarcastically. He demonstrated, and at last contemptuously ceased to demonstrate, like a mathematician who ceases to prove in various ways the accuracy of a problem that has already been proved. Voltsogen took his place and continued to explain his views in French, every now and then turning to Fuel and saying, "Is it not so, Your Excellency?" But Fuel, like a man heated in a fight, who strikes those on his own side, shouted angrily at his own supporter, Voltsogen, "Well, of course! What more is there to explain?" Paolucci and Michaud both attacked Voltsogen simultaneously in French. Armfelt addressed Fuel in German. Toll explained to Volkonsky in Russian. Prince Andrei listened and observed in silence. Of all these men, Prince Andrei sympathized most with Fuel, angry, determined,
and absurdly self-confident as he was. Of all those present, evidently he alone was not seeking anything for himself, nursed no hatred against anyone, and only desired that the plan, formed on a theory arrived at by years of toil, should be carried out. He was ridiculous and unpleasantly sarcastic, but yet he inspired involuntary respect by his boundless devotion to an idea. Besides this, the remarks of all except Fuel had one common trait that had not been noticeable at the Council of War in 1805. There was now a panic fear of Napoleon's genius, which, though concealed, was noticeable in every rejoinder. Everything was assumed to be possible for Napoleon. They expected him from every side and invoked his terrible name to shatter each other's proposals. Pfuel alone seemed to consider Napoleon a barbarian, like everyone else who opposed his theory. But besides this feeling of respect, Pfuel evoked pity in Prince Andrei. From the tone in which the courtiers addressed him and the way Paolucci had allowed himself to speak of him to the emperor, but above all from a certain desperation in Fuel's own expressions, it was clear that the others knew, and Fuel himself felt, that his fall was at hand. And despite his self-confidence and grumpy German sarcasm, he was pitiable, with his hair smoothly brushed on the temples and sticking up in tufts behind. Though he concealed the fact under a show of irritation and contempt, he was evidently in despair that the sole remaining chance of verifying his theory by a huge experiment and proving its soundness to the whole world was slipping away from him. The discussions continued a long time, and the longer they lasted, the more heated became the disputes, culminating in shouts and personalities, and the less was it possible to arrive at any general conclusion from all that had been said. Prince Andrei, listening to this polyglot talk and to these surmises, plans, refutations, and shouts, felt nothing but amazement at what they were saying. A thought that had long since and often occurred to him during his military activities, the idea that there is not and cannot be any science of war, and that therefore there can be no such thing as a military genius, now appeared to him an obvious truth. What theory and science is possible about a matter the conditions and circumstances of which are unknown and cannot be defined, especially when the strength of the acting forces cannot be ascertained? No one was or is able to foresee in what condition our or the enemy's armies will be in a day's time, and no one can gauge the force of this or that detachment. Sometimes, when there is not a coward at the front to shout, "We are cut off," and start running, but a brave and jolly lad who shouts, "Hurrah!" a detachment of 5,000 is worth 30,000, as at Schöngraben, while at times 50,000 run from 8,000, as at Austerlitz. What science can there be in a matter in which, as in all practical matters, nothing can be defined and everything depends on innumerable conditions, the significance of which is determined at a particular moment, which arrives no one knows when? Armfelt says our army is cut in half, and Paolucci says we have got the French army between two fires. Michaud says that the worthlessness of the Drissa camp lies in having the river behind it, and Fuel says that that is what constitutes its strength. Toll proposes one plan, Armfelt another, and they are all good and all bad, and the advantages of any suggestions can be seen only at the moment of trial. And why do they all speak of a military genius? Is a man a genius who can order bread to be brought up at the right time, and say who is to go to the right and who to the left? It is only because military men are invested with pomp and power, and crowds of sycophants flatter power, attributing to it qualities of genius it does not possess. The best generals I have known were, on the contrary, stupid or absent-minded men. Bagration was the best. Napoleon himself admitted that. And of Bonaparte himself, I remember his limited, self-satisfied face on the field at Austerlitz. Not only does a good army commander not need any special qualities, on the contrary, he needs the absence of the highest and best human attributes, love, poetry, tenderness, and philosophic inquiring doubt. He should be limited,
firmly convinced that what he is doing is very important, otherwise he will not have sufficient patience, and only then will he be a brave leader. God forbid that he should be humane, should love or pity, or think of what is just and unjust. It is understandable that a theory of their genius was invented for them long ago because they have power. The success of a military action depends not on them, but on the man in the ranks who shouts, "We are lost," or who shouts, "Hurrah!" And only in the ranks can one serve with assurance of being useful. So thought Prince Andrei as he listened to the talking, and he roused himself only when Paolucci called him and everyone was leaving. At the review next day, the Emperor asked Prince Andrei where he would like to serve, and Prince Andrei lost his standing in court circles forever by not asking to remain attached to the sovereign's person, but for permission to serve in the army. Chapter 12. Nikolai writes to Sonia. Before the beginning of the campaign, Rostov had received a letter from his parents in which they told him briefly of Natasha's illness and the breaking off of her engagement to Prince Andrei, which they explained by Natasha's having rejected him, and again asked Nikolai to retire from the army and return home. On receiving this letter, Nikolai did not even make any attempt to get leave of absence or to retire from the army, but wrote to his parents that he was sorry Natasha was ill and her engagement broken off, and that he would do all he could to meet their wishes. To Sonia he wrote separately. "Adored friend of my soul," he wrote, "nothing but honour could keep me from returning to the country, but now, at the commencement of the campaign, I should feel dishonoured, not only in my comrades' eyes, but in my own, if I preferred my own happiness to my love and duty to the fatherland. But this shall be our last separation. Believe me, directly the war is over, if I am still alive and still loved by you, I will throw up everything and fly to you, to press you for ever to my ardent breast." It was, in fact, only the commencement of the campaign that prevented Rostov from returning home as he had promised and marrying Sonia. The autumn in Otradnoye with the hunting and the winter with the Christmas holidays and Sonia's love had opened out to him a vista of tranquil rural joys and peace such as he had never known before and which now allured him. A splendid wife, children, a good pack of hounds, a dozen leashes of smart bourgeois, agriculture, neighbours, service by election, thought he. But now the campaign was beginning, and he had to remain with his regiment. And since it had to be so, Nikolai Rostov, as was natural to him, felt contented with the life he led in the regiment, and was able to find pleasure in that life. On his return from his furlough, Nikolai, having been joyfully welcomed by his comrades, was sent to obtain remounts and brought back from the Ukraine excellent horses, which pleased him and earned him commendation from his commanders. During his absence he had been promoted captain, and when the regiment was put on war footing with an increase in numbers, he was again allotted his old squadron. The campaign began. The regiment was moved into Poland on double pay. New officers arrived, new men and horses, and above all, everybody was infected with the merrily excited mood that goes with the commencement of a war, and Rostov, conscious of his advantageous position in the regiment, devoted himself entirely to the pleasures and interests of military service, though he knew that sooner or later he would have to relinquish them. The troops retired from Vilna, for various complicated reasons of state, political and strategic. Each step of the retreat was accompanied by a complicated interplay of interests, arguments and passions at headquarters. For the Pavlograd Hussars, however, the whole of this retreat during the finest period of summer and with sufficient supplies was a very simple and agreeable business. It was only at headquarters that there was depression, uneasiness, and intriguing. In the body of the army they did not ask themselves where they were going or why. If they regretted having to retreat, it was only because they had to leave billets they had grown accustomed to, or some pretty young Polish lady. If the thought that things looked bad chanced to enter anyone's head, he tried to be as cheerful as befits a good soldier, and not to think of the general trend of affairs, but only of the task nearest to hand. First they camped gaily before Vilna, making acquaintance with the Polish landowners, preparing for reviews and being reviewed by the Emperor and other high commanders. Then came an order to retreat to Svensiany and destroy any provisions they could not carry away with them. Svensiany was remembered by the hussars only as the Drunken Camp, a name the whole army gave to their encampment there, and because many complaints were made against the troops, who, taking advantage of the order to collect provisions, took also horses, carriages, and carpets from the Polish proprietors. Rostov remembered Svensiany because on the first day of their arrival at that small town, he changed his sergeant-major and was unable to manage all the drunken men of his squadron, who, unknown to him, had appropriated 5 barrels of old beer. From Svensiany they retired farther and farther to Drissa, and thence again beyond Drissa, drawing near to the frontier of Russia proper. On the 13th of July, the Pavlograds took part in a serious action for the first time. On the 12th of July, on the eve of that action, there was a heavy storm of rain and hail. In general, the summer of 1812 was remarkable for its storms. The 2 Pavlograd squadrons were bivouacking on a field of rye, which was already in ear, but had been completely trodden down by cattle and horses. The rain was descending in torrents, and Rostov, with a young officer named Ilin, his protégé, was sitting in a hastily constructed shelter. An officer of their regiment, with long moustaches extending onto his cheeks, who, after riding to the staff, had been overtaken by the rain, entered Rostov's shelter.
"I have come from the staff, Count. Have you heard of Raevsky's exploit?"
And the officer gave them details of the Saltanov battle, which he had heard at the staff. Rostov, smoking his pipe and turning his head about as the water trickled down his neck, listened inattentively, with an occasional glance at Ilin, who was pressing close to him. This officer, a lad of 16 who had recently joined the regiment, was now in the same relation to Nikolai that Nikolai had been to Denisov 7 years before. Ilin tried to imitate Rostov in everything, and adored him, as a girl might have done. Strzezinski, the officer with the long moustache, spoke grandiloquently of the Saltanov Dam being a Russian Thermopylae, and of how a deed worthy of antiquity had been performed by General Raevsky. He recounted how Raevsky had led his 2 sons onto the dam under terrific fire, and had charged with them beside him. Rostov heard the story, and not only said nothing to encourage Strzezinski's enthusiasm, but on the contrary, looked like a man ashamed of what he was hearing, though with no intention of contradicting it. Since the campaigns of Austerlitz and of 1807, Rostov knew by experience that men always lie when describing military exploits, as he himself had done when recounting them. Besides that, he had experience enough to know that nothing happens in war at all as we can imagine or relate it. And so he did not like Strzezinski's tale, nor did he like Strzezinski himself, who, with his moustaches extending over his cheeks, bent low over the face of his hearer, as was his habit, and crowded Rostov in the narrow shanty. Rostov looked at him in silence. In the first place, there must have been such a confusion and crowding on the dam that was being attacked, that if Raevsky did lead his sons there, it could have had no effect except perhaps on some dozen men nearest to him, thought he. The rest could not have seen how or with whom Raevsky came on to the dam, and even those who did see it would not have been much stimulated by it, for what had they to do with Raevsky's tender paternal feelings when their own skins were in danger? And besides, the fate of the fatherland did not depend on whether they took the Saltanov Dam or not, as we are told was the case at Thermopylae, so why should he have made such a sacrifice, and why expose his own children in the battle? I would not have taken my brother Petya there, or even Eileen, who's a stranger to me but a nice lad, but would have tried to put them somewhere under cover," Nikolai continued to think, as he listened to Zdrzhinsky. But he did not express his thoughts, for in such matters, too, he had gained experience. He knew that this tale redounded to the glory of our arms, and so one had to pretend not to doubt it. And he acted accordingly. "I can't stand this any more," said Eileen, noticing that Rostov did not relish Drzezinski's conversation. "My stockings and shirt, and the water is running on my seat. I'll go and look for shelter. The rain seems less heavy." Eileen went out, and Drzezinski rode away. 5 minutes later, Eileen, splashing through the mud, came running back to the shanty.
"Hurrah! Rostov, come quickly! I've found it! About 200 yards away, there's a tavern where ours have already gathered. We can at least get dry there, and Maria Hendrikovna's there."
Maria Hendrikovna was the wife of the regimental doctor, a pretty young German woman he had married in Poland. The doctor, whether from lack of means or because he did not like to part from his young wife in the early days of their marriage, took her about with him wherever the Hussar regiment went, and his jealousy had become a standing joke among the Hussar officers. Rostov threw his cloak over his shoulders, shouted to Lavrushka to follow with the things, and, now slipping in the mud, now splashing right through it, set off with Eileen in the lessening rain and the darkness that was occasionally rent by distant lightning.
"Rostov, where are you?"
"Here."
"What lightning!"
they called to one another. Chapter 13. Maria Hendrikovna. In the tavern before which stood the doctor's covered cart, there were already some 5 officers. Maria Hendrikovna, a plump little blonde German in a dressing jacket and nightcap, was sitting on a broad bench in the front corner. Her husband, the doctor, lay asleep behind her. Rostov and Eileen, on entering the room, were welcomed with merry shouts and laughter.
"Dear me, how jolly we are," said Rostov, laughing. "And why do you stand there gaping? Oh, what swells they are! Why, the water streams from them! Don't make our drawing-room so wet! Don't mess Maria Hendrikovna's dress!" cried other voices.
Rostov and Eileen hastened to find a corner where they could change into dry clothes without offending Maria Hendrikovna's modesty. They were going into a tiny recess behind a partition to change, but found it completely filled by 3 officers who sat playing cards by the light of a solitary candle on an empty box, and these officers would on no account yield their position. Maria Hendrikovna obliged them with the loan of a petticoat to be used as a curtain, and behind that screen Rostov and Eileen, helped by Lavrushka, who had brought their kits, changed their wet things for dry ones. A fire was made up in the dilapidated brick stove. A board was found, fixed on 2 saddles and covered with a horsecloth. A small samovar was produced, and a cellaret and 1/2 bottle of rum. And having asked Maria Hendrikovna to preside, they all crowded round her. One offered her a clean handkerchief to wipe her charming hands, another spread a jacket under her little feet to keep them from the damp, another hung his coat over the window to keep out the draught, and yet another waved the flies off her husband's face, lest he should wake up.
"Leave him alone," said Maria Hendrikovna, smiling timidly and happily. "He is sleeping well as it is, after a sleepless night."
"Oh, no, Maria Hendrikovna," replied the officer. "One must look after the doctor. Perhaps he'll take pity on me some day when it comes to cutting off a leg or an arm for me."
There were only 3 tumblers. The water was so muddy that one couldn't make out whether the tea was strong or weak, and the samovar held only 6 tumblers of water. But this made it all the pleasanter to take turns in order of seniority to receive one's tumbler from Maria Hendrikovna's plump little hands with their short and not over-clean nails. All the officers appeared to be, and really were, in love with her that evening.
Even those playing cards behind the partition soon left their game and came over to the samovar, yielding to the general mood of courting Marya Hendrikovna. She, seeing herself surrounded by such brilliant and polite young men, beamed with satisfaction, try as she might to hide it, and perturbed as she evidently was each time her husband moved in his sleep behind her. There was only one spoon. Sugar was more plentiful than anything else, but it took too long to dissolve, so it was decided that Marya Hendrikovna should stir the sugar for everyone in turn. Rostov received his tumbler, and adding some rum to it, asked Marya Hendrikovna to stir it.
"But you take it without sugar?" she said, smiling all the time, as if everything she said and everything the others said was very amusing and had a double meaning.
"It's not the sugar I want, but only that your little hand should stir my tea."
Marya Hendrikovna assented and began looking for the spoon which someone meanwhile had pounced on.
"Use your finger, Marya Hendrikovna. It will be still nicer," said Rostov.
"Too hot," she replied, blushing with pleasure.
Ilyin put a few drops of rum into the bucket of water and brought it to Marya Hendrikovna, asking her to stir it with her finger.
"This is my cup," said he. "Only dip your finger in it, and I'll drink it all up."
When they had emptied the samovar, Rostov took a pack of cards and proposed that they should play kings with Marya Hendrikovna. They drew lots to settle who should make up her set. At Rostov's suggestion, it was agreed that whoever became king should have the right to kiss Marya Hendrikovna's hand, and that the booby should go to refill and reheat the samovar for the doctor when the latter awoke.
"Well, but supposing Marya Hendrikovna is king?" asked Ilyin.
"As it is, she is queen, and her word is law."
They had hardly begun to play before the doctor's dishevelled head suddenly appeared from behind Marya Hendrikovna. He had been awake for some time, listening to what was being said, and evidently found nothing entertaining or amusing in what was going on. His face was sad and depressed. Without greeting the officers, he scratched himself and asked to be allowed to pass as they were blocking the way. As soon as he had left the room, all the officers burst into loud laughter, and Marya Hendrikovna blushed till her eyes filled with tears, and thereby became still more attractive to them. Returning from the yard, the doctor told his wife, who had ceased to smile so happily and looked at him in alarm, awaiting her sentence, that the rain had ceased and they must go to sleep in their covered cart, or everything in it would be stolen.
"But I'll send an orderly, two of them," said Rostov. "What an idea, doctor!"
"I'll stand guard on it myself," said Ilyin.
"No, gentlemen, you have had your sleep, but I have not slept for 2 nights," replied the doctor, and he sat down morosely beside his wife, waiting for the game to end.
Seeing his gloomy face as he frowned at his wife, the officers grew still merrier, and some of them could not refrain from laughter, for which they hurriedly sought plausible pretexts. When he had gone, taking his wife with him, and had settled down with her in their covered cart, the officers lay down in the tavern, covering themselves with their wet cloaks, but they did not sleep for a long time. Now they exchanged remarks, recalling the doctor's uneasiness and his wife's delight. Now they ran out into the porch and reported what was taking place in the covered trap. Several times Rostov, covering his head, tried to go to sleep, but some remark would arouse him and conversation would be resumed, to the accompaniment of unreasoning, merry, childlike laughter.
Chapter 14. Rostov goes into action. It was nearly 3 o'clock, but no one was yet asleep, when the quartermaster appeared with an order to move on to the little town of Ostrovna. Still laughing and talking, the officers began hurriedly getting ready, and again boiled some muddy water in the samovar. But Rostov went off to his squadron without waiting for tea. Day was breaking, the rain had ceased, and the clouds were dispersing. It felt damp and cold, especially in clothes that were still moist. As they left the tavern in the twilight of the dawn, Rostov and Ilyin both glanced under the wet and glistening leather hood of the doctor's cart, from under the apron of which his feet were sticking out, and in the middle of which his wife's nightcap was visible and her sleepy breathing audible. "She really is a dear little thing," said Rostov to Ilyin, who was following him. "A charming woman," said Ilyin, with all the gravity of a boy of 16. Half an hour later the squadron was lined up on the road. The command was heard to mount, and the soldiers crossed themselves and mounted. Rostov, riding in front, gave the order, "Forward!" And the hussars, with clanking sabres and subdued talk, their horses' hoofs splashing in the mud, defiled in fours and moved along the broad road planted with birch trees on either side, following the infantry and a battery that had gone on in front. Tattered, blue-purple clouds, reddening in the east, were scudding before the wind. It was growing lighter and lighter. That curly grass which always grows by country roadsides became clearly visible, still wet with the night's rain. The drooping branches of the birches, also wet, swayed in the wind and flung down bright drops of water to one side. The soldiers' faces were more and more clearly visible. Rostov, always closely followed by Ilyin, rode along the side of the road between two rows of birch trees. When campaigning, Rostov allowed himself the indulgence of riding not a regimental but a Cossack horse. A judge of horses and a sportsman, he had lately procured himself a large, fine, mettlesome Donets horse, dun-coloured, with a light mane and tail, and when he rode it no one could out-gallop him. To ride this horse was a pleasure to him, and he thought of the horse, of the morning, of the doctor's wife, but not once of the impending danger. Formerly, when going into action, Rostov had felt afraid. Now he had not the least feeling of fear. He was fearless not because he had grown used to being under fire, one cannot grow used to danger, but because he had learned how to manage his thoughts when in danger. He had grown accustomed, when going into action, to think about anything but what would seem most likely to interest him, the impending danger. During the first period of his service, hard as he tried and much as he reproached himself with cowardice, he had not been able to do this, but with time it had come of itself. Now he rode beside Ilyin under the birch trees, occasionally plucking leaves from a branch that met his hand, sometimes touching his horse's side with his foot, or, without turning round, handing a pipe he had finished to an hussar riding behind him, with as calm and careless an air as though he were merely out for a ride. He glanced with pity at the excited face of Ilyin, who talked much and in great agitation. He knew from experience the tormenting expectation of terror and death the cornet was suffering, and he knew that only time could help him. As soon as the sun appeared in a clear strip of sky beneath the clouds, the wind fell, as if it dared not spoil the beauty of the summer morning after the storm. Drops still continued to fall, but vertically now, and all was still. The whole sun appeared on the horizon, and disappeared behind a long, narrow cloud that hung above it. A few minutes later it reappeared brighter still from behind the top of the cloud, tearing its edge. Everything grew bright and glittered. And with that light, and as if in reply to it, came the sound of guns ahead of them. Before Rostov had had time to consider and determine the distance of that firing, Count Ostermann Tolstoy's adjutant came galloping from Vitebsk with orders to advance at a trot along the road. The squadron overtook and passed the infantry and the battery, which had also quickened their pace, rode down a hill, and passing through an empty and deserted village again ascended. The horses began to lather and the men to flush. "Halt! Dress your ranks!" The order of the regimental commander was heard ahead. "Forward by the left! Walk, march!" came the order from in front. And the hussars, passing along the line of troops on the left flank of our position, halted behind our Uhlans, who were in the front line. To the right stood our infantry in a dense column. They were the reserve. Higher up the hill, on the very horizon, our guns were visible through the wonderfully clear air, brightly illuminated by slanting morning sunbeams. In front, beyond a hollow dale, could be seen the enemy's columns and guns. Our advanced line, already in action, could be heard briskly exchanging shots with the enemy in the dale. At these sounds, long unheard, Rostov's spirits rose, as at the strains of the merriest music. "Trap, ta-ta-tap!" cracked the shots, now together, now several quickly, one after another. Again all was silent, and then again it sounded as if someone were walking on detonators and exploding them. The hussars remained in the same place for about an hour. A cannonade began. Count Ostermann with his suite rode up behind the squadron, halted, spoke to the commander of the regiment, and rode up the hill to the guns. After Ostermann had gone, a command rang out to the Uhlans, "Form column! Prepare to charge!" The infantry in front of them parted into platoons to allow the cavalry to pass. The Uhlans started, the streamers on their spears fluttering, and trotted downhill toward the French cavalry, which was seen below to the left. As soon as the Uhlans descended the hill, the hussars were ordered up the hill to support the battery. As they took the places vacated by the Uhlans, bullets came from the front, whining and whistling, but fell spent without taking effect. The sounds which he had not heard for so long had an even more pleasurable and exhilarating effect on Rostov than the previous sounds of firing. Drawing himself up, he viewed the field of battle opening out before him from the hill, and with his whole soul followed the movement of the Uhlans. They swooped down close to the French dragoons. Something confused happened there amid the smoke, and 5 minutes later our Uhlans were galloping back, not to the place they had occupied, but more to the left, and among the orange-coloured Uhlans on chestnut horses, and behind them in a large group, blue French dragoons on grey horses could be seen. Chapter 15. Rostov's hussars charged the French dragoons. Rostov, with his keen sportsman's eye, was one of the first to catch sight of these blue French dragoons pursuing our Uhlans. Nearer and nearer in disorderly crowds came the Uhlans and the French dragoons pursuing them. He could already see how these men, who looked so small at the foot of the hill, jostled and overtook one another, waving their arms and their sabres in the air. Rostov gazed at what was happening before him as at a hunt. He felt instinctively that if the hussars struck at the French dragoons now, the latter could not withstand them. But if a charge was to be made, it must be done now, at that very moment, or it would be too late. He looked around. A captain, standing beside him, was gazing like himself with eyes fixed on the cavalry below them. "Andrei Sevastyanich," said Rostov, "you know, we could crush them." "A fine thing, too," replied the captain. "And really..." Rostov, without waiting to hear him out, touched his horse, galloped to the front of his squadron, and before he had time to finish giving the word of command, the whole squadron, sharing his feeling, was following him. Rostov himself did not know how or why he did it. He acted as he did when hunting, without reflecting or considering. He saw the dragoons near and that they were galloping in disorder. He knew that they could not withstand an attack, knew there was only that moment, and that if he let it slip it would not return. The bullets were whining and whistling so stimulatingly around him, and his horse was so eager to go that he could not restrain himself. He touched his horse, gave the word of command, and immediately hearing behind him the tramp of the horses of his deployed squadron, rode at full trot downhill towards the dragoons. Hardly had they reached the bottom of the hill before their pace instinctively changed to a gallop, which grew faster and faster as they drew nearer to our Uhlans and the French dragoons who galloped after them. The dragoons were now close at hand. On seeing the hussars, the foremost began to turn, while those behind began to halt. With the same feeling with which he had galloped across the path of a wolf, Rostov gave rein to his Donets horse and galloped to intersect the path of the dragoons' disordered lines. One Uhlan stopped, another, who was on foot, flung himself to the ground to avoid being knocked over, and a riderless horse fell in among the hussars. Nearly all the French dragoons were galloping back. Rostov, picking out one on a grey horse, dashed after him. On the way he came upon a bush. His gallant horse cleared it, and almost before he had righted himself in his saddle, he saw that he would immediately overtake the enemy he had selected. That Frenchman, by his uniform an officer, was going at a gallop, crouching on his grey horse and urging it on with his sabre. In another moment Rostov's horse dashed its breast against the hindquarters of the officer's horse, almost knocking it over, and at the same instant Rostov, without knowing why, raised his sabre and struck the Frenchman with it. The instant he had done this, all Rostov's animation vanished. The officer fell, not so much from the blow, which had but slightly cut his arm above the elbow, as from the shock to his horse and from fright. Rostov reined in his horse, and his eyes sought his foe to see whom he had vanquished. The French dragoon officer was hopping with one foot on the ground, the other being caught in the stirrup. His eyes, screwed up with fear as if he every moment expected another blow, gazed up at Rostov with shrinking terror. His pale and mud-stained face, fair and young, with a dimple in the chin and light blue eyes, was not an enemy's face at all suited to a battlefield, but a most ordinary, homelike face. Before Rostov had decided what to do with him, the officer cried, "I surrender!" He hurriedly but vainly tried to get his foot out of the stirrup, and did not remove his frightened blue eyes from Rostov's face. Some hussars who galloped up disengaged his foot and helped him into the saddle. On all sides the hussars were busy with the dragoons. One was wounded, but though his face was bleeding, he would not give up his horse. Another was perched up behind an hussar with his arms round him. A third was being helped by an hussar to mount his horse. In front, the French infantry were firing as they ran. The hussars galloped hastily back with their prisoners. Rostov galloped back with the rest, aware of an unpleasant feeling of depression in his heart. Something vague and confused, which he could not at all account for, had come over him with the capture of that officer and the blow he had dealt him. Count Ostermann Tolstoy met the returning hussars, sent for Rostov, thanked him, and said he would report his gallant deed to the Emperor and would recommend him for a St. George's Cross. When sent for by Count Ostermann, Rostov, remembering that he had charged without orders, felt sure his commander was sending for him to punish him for breach of discipline. Osterman's flattering words and promise of a reward should therefore have struck him all the more pleasantly, but he still felt that same vaguely disagreeable feeling of moral nausea. "But what on earth is worrying me?" he asked himself as he rode back from the general. "Ilyin? No, he's safe. Have I disgraced myself in any way? No, that's not it." Something else, resembling remorse, tormented him. Yes. Oh, yes, that French officer with the dimple. And I remember how my arm paused when I raised it. Rostov saw the prisoners being led away and galloped after them to have a look at his Frenchman with the dimple on his chin. He was sitting in his foreign uniform on an hussar pack horse and looked anxiously about him. The sword cut on his arm could scarcely be called a wound. He glanced at Rostov with a feigned smile and waved his hand in greeting. Rostov still had the same indefinite feeling as of shame. All that day and the next, his friends and comrades noticed that Rostov, without being dull or angry, was silent, thoughtful and preoccupied. He drank reluctantly, tried to remain alone, and kept turning something over in his mind. Rostov was always thinking about that brilliant exploit of his, which to his amazement had gained him the St. George's Cross and even given him a reputation for bravery, and there was something he could not at all understand. "So others are even more afraid than I am," he thought. "So that's all there is in what is called heroism. And heroism? And did I do it for my country's sake? And how was he to blame, with his dimple and blue eyes? And how frightened he was. He thought that I should kill him. Why should I kill him? My hand trembled. And they have given me a St. George's Cross. I can't make it out at all." but while Nikolai was considering these questions and still could reach no clear solution of what puzzled him so, the wheel of fortune in the service, as often happens, turned in his favour. After the affair at Ostrovna, he was brought into notice, received command of an hussar battalion, and when a brave officer was needed, he was chosen. Chapter 16. Natasha's Illness. On receiving news of Natasha's illness, the Countess, though not quite well yet and still weak, went to Moscow with Petya and the rest of the household, and the whole family moved from Maria Dmitrievna's house to their own and settled down in town. Natasha's illness was so serious that, fortunately